From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, sick and tired, we examine the ongoing problems plaguing the healthcare law rollout. Marijuana majority. A new poll suggests most Americans support the legalization of the drug.
Moving in a direction of trying new state laws and seeing if there's a better approach to marijuana prohibition. You know, most Americans think that there is a better approach to marijuana prohibition.
We head to New York as the UN pushes for more women in international peacekeeping roles. And the case of the Catholic Church and Germany's Bishop of Bling.
He is said to have spent up to $20,000 on a bathtub, $30,000 on a conference table. It's this kind of spending that you can imagine is really making people angry.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after a summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. The Pakistani President Nawaz Sharif held historic talks at the White House with President Obama as the two men strive to forge a more productive relationship. The Pakistani leader says he wants the U.S. to end drone airstrikes on his country's territory, but talks also touched on a wide range of other, less contentious issues. Washington correspondent Simon Mark says both sides hope the Pakistani leader's visit can reframe the bilateral relationship between Washington and Islamabad.
Some here have called this the kiss and make up summit between the US and Pakistan, coming as it does after years of strain caused first by the raid on Osama bin Laden's compound in Abbottabad, then by the relentless use of US drones to target militants along the Pakistani border with Afghanistan. The US tried to sweeten this visit, offering Pakistan $1.5 billion in assistance that was previously frozen, and the two sides have indicated they hope that these talks go beyond the disagreement over the use of drones and focus on regional security.
Russia's investigative committee has reassessed charges of 30 arrested Greenpeace activists, downgrading them from piracy to less severe hooliganism charges. Under the new accusations, activists could still face up to 7 years in prison, but Greenpeace hopes that all charges will be dropped. Daria Bondarchuk reports from Moscow.
The Greenpeace activists are accused of hooliganism, a violation provisioned by Article 213 of the Russian Criminal Code, the investigators stated. However, Greenpeace said it expects that the Russian investigative committee will drop all charges against the Arctic Sunrise crew detained for protesting against oil drilling in the Pechora Sea in September. The program director of Greenpeace Russia, Ivan Blokov, told Russian media that there was no issue for charges or criminal case. So far, all 30 bail applications in the case have been refused by the court in Murmansk.
German Chancellor Angela Merkel is the latest to take the Obama administration to task on international spying. The chancellor allegedly called the U.S. president to warn of consequences if proof comes out that her personal cell phone was tapped. The White House has denied claims of spying on Germany, but National Security Agency spying revelations are consistent with German fears. And the man accused of masterminding the 1998 U.S. embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania has appeared for a second time in a New York court. Abu Anas al-Libi was seized from Libya last month by U.S. commandos. Nick Harper reports from New York.
At this second court appearance, the man charged with being behind the bombings was present for discussions on his legal counsel. It's reported that al-Libi's lawyer has been paid for by the Libyan government. Al-Libi himself has pleaded not guilty to the charges against him. His lawyer, Bernard Kleinman, says it will take several months to work through hundreds of thousands of documents before the case can come to trial.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Political pressure is growing on U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services Kathleen Sebelius to resign. Following the less than successful rollout of the websites to obtain health care insurance under the Affordable Care Act, Republicans are saying the buck stops with Secretary Sebelius. From Washington, Priscilla Huff has more.
As the number two Republican in the U.S. House of Representatives, Eric Cantor, put it,
the rollout of Obamacare is nothing short of a debacle.
And Republicans are trying to capitalize on the problems, calling for the resignation of Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius. The Obama administration has assigned the task of a technology surge to get the healthcare insurance websites working to Jeff Zients and pulled in consultants from Silicon Valley. But that is not satisfying the Republicans. They keep asking questions about whether Secretary Sebelius misled everyone that the technology was not ready for the rollout and when the repair deadline is, and about why she is unavailable for congressional hearings until next week.
Iran's justice minister has said there is no need to attempt a second execution of the 37-year-old convicted drug smuggler known as Ali Reza M. Ali Reza was found alive after being hung for 12 minutes last week, and according to the Iranian official news agency, he may now be in a coma. Amnesty International, who opposes the use of the death penalty, say that international outcry may be changing minds in Iran. And the worst of the fire danger on Australia's Blue Mountains has passed, although the flames blaze on in many areas. Arthur Stevens reports from Melbourne.
The New South Wales Rural Fire Service Commissioner Shane Fitzsimmons says the major fire threat to the west of Sydney has been averted, and it's now safe for Blue Mountains residents to return to their homes. Mr. Fitzsimmons has paid tribute to the emergency services and the community for heeding the advice of the fire service as fires flared up in the mountains and new blazes erupted in the Hunter Valley region near Newcastle.
And that's the latest feature story news. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. Republican criticisms of the Affordable Care Act have dominated Washington for years and were a driving force behind this month's government shutdown. But as problems continue to plague the healthcare exchange's rollout, fellow Democrats and independent progressives are raising concerns as well, from accessibility to cost to the benefit to private insurance corporations. Many feel torn between defending the law against attacks from the right wing and calling for a more inclusive system. On Capitol Hill, Alice Olstein reports.
The Obama administration is taking action this week to attempt to resolve the problems with the Affordable Care Act. The president appointed Jeff Zients, the former acting director of the Office of Management and Budget, to oversee the team working to fix the federal website that serves as the portal for millions of Americans to sign up for insurance. On Tuesday, the Department of Health and Human Services announced what they're calling a tech surge, recruiting experts from the government, outside contractors, and private corporations, including unnamed top Silicon Valley companies. House Democrats attended a briefing behind closed doors Wednesday morning with Mike Hash, who leads the administration's Office of Health Reform. And many, including Massachusetts Democrat Jim McGovern, said they left the meeting reassured.
I believe this is going to work, and we didn't fight to pass healthcare reform to create a website. We fought to pass healthcare reform to get people enrolled in healthcare who need it.
But other members, including New Jersey Democrat Bill Pascrell, left the meeting with lingering questions about the tech companies involved.
How they were hired? Who recommended them? Some of them are here since the Bush administration.
How many people have successfully enrolled?
We need numbers. We want to see numbers, just like everybody.
And whether people who fail to enroll by the January deadline because of technical difficulties will be penalized.
If their problems are as intense as they are this morning, then maybe we'd have to consider a short delay in terms of the individual mandate.
Pascrell and several other Democrats said they learned in the briefing that in states that set up their own exchanges and voluntarily expanded Medicaid to more of their low-income residents, the enrollment process was much smoother than in states that refused to do both. California Democrat Ami Bera, who worked as a doctor before joining Congress this year, said the Obama administration miscalculated in betting that all states would come on board.
I do think they thought more states would embrace it. And, you know, governor's role in those states that haven't embraced it, you know, they're putting their residents at a disadvantage. So, you know, states like Texas and Florida that are complaining about this, they ought to take a look at themselves as well and say, you know, why didn't they work on it themselves?
Senate Democrats are concerned, too. In a letter to President Obama this week, New Hampshire's Jean Shaheen called for an extension of the open enrollment period, saying she's concerned those who try and fail to register online will become frustrated and won't try again later. But some on the left believe there has been too much focus on healthcare.gov and not enough on the healthcare itself.
The website is the easiest way to attack the Affordable Care Act and not really talk about the real issues.
That's Dr. Margaret Flowers, who serves as the health secretary for the Green Party's shadow cabinet, an organization created this year to push for policies and ideas not represented by Democrats or Republicans.
The conversation we really need to be having is does healthcare belong in the marketplace at all? Do you see healthcare as a commodity in which people should only be able to have access to the amount of healthcare they can afford? Or do you see healthcare as a public good, something that benefits the entire society if people are able to get the healthcare they need? And recognizing that countries that treat it that way actually spend less and have better health outcomes than the United States does.
Flowers is an advocate for a single-payer public healthcare system, which she said would solve the current problem of website overloads because all Americans would be automatically enrolled.
You know, just like public education, it pays for the hospitals, it pays for the staff, and when people become sick or have a problem, they can go to any of the facilities and they can get care. They don't have to pass a test to get through the front door of, you know, whether they have the cash on hand or an insurance card to get the treatment that they need.
Some progressive members of Congress are also pushing for a single-payer system, such as expanding Medicaid eligibility to all U.S. residents. Meanwhile, many Republicans continue to blast the Obama administration for the problems with the Affordable Care Act and are demanding the resignation of Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius, a key architect of the law and its implementation. Sebelius will come to Capitol Hill next week to face questions from the Republican-controlled House Commerce Health Subcommittee. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
First-class flights, a $20,000 bathtub, and an eight-figure property renovation. Not the spending spree of a Wall Street hedge fund manager, but that of a Catholic bishop. Franz Peter ter Bartz van Elst has been suspended from his position in Germany amid accusations surrounding his lavish lifestyle. Earlier, I spoke to Rome-based correspondent Josephine McKenna.
Well, this bishop, Franz Peter ter Bartz van Elst, has been accused of spending more than $40 million on renovating his official residence. Now, he says this amount of money was spent on 10 separate projects, and he has apologized, but that's not enough for the Vatican. The Vatican has ordered that he be immediately suspended, and that's come only 2 days after he met Pope Francis. There still seems to be no indication of what he'll do next, but this is certainly a major decision from the Vatican today.
So what exactly was he spending his money on?
Well, his behaviour is apparently well known in Germany. He was once accused of taking a first-class flight to visit the poor in India, but it's these home renovations, the renovations of his official residence, that has provoked the anger of Catholics, not only in Germany but elsewhere. So he is said to have spent up to $20,000 on a bathtub, $30,000 on a conference table. It's this kind of spending that you can imagine is really making people angry, when, particularly when people contribute so much money to the church as parishioners.
This sort of decadence, this is in stark contrast to the way that Pope Francis has been running things since he came into the role.
Yes, that's absolutely right. From the day he was elected, Pope Francis has preached a message of humility. He's not only chosen the name of Italy's patron saint, Francis, who was well known for working with the poor and throwing away his own material possessions, but this pope has abandoned the formal papal apartment. He rejects the formality of his office, and he lives in a very simple room where he eats very quietly with his clerics and nuns and people who visit him at the Vatican. He is really opposed to any kind of elaborate pomp and circumstance, and he has set this agenda from the beginning of his papacy, and we've seen that also in the visits that he's made. His first visit to Lampedusa to show his support for migrants, his visit to Latin America. This is a pope who does not want to be seen to be supporting a Catholic church that supports hierarchies and trappings of office.
Josephine McKenna in Rome. Last week, the UN Security Council passed a resolution calling for more women to be brought to the peacekeeping table, traditionally the domain of men. But the United Nations itself has had trouble ending sexual abuse among its own partners. Our UN reporter, Stephen Fee, has the story.
The draft resolution received 15 votes in favour. 15 hands in the air, a unanimous vote for the first council directive in more than a decade that directly calls for women's full participation in global peacemaking. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon spoke immediately after the vote.
Women's participation in peace efforts is a matter of gender equality and universal human rights, and crucial to achieving sustainable peace, economic recovery, social cohesion, and political legitimacy. Today's resolution makes that point loud and clear.
A blossoming refugee crisis in Syria and warfare in sub-Saharan Africa have put women's lives at risk and has put their plight in sharp focus. Fumzile Mlambo-Nuka is the newly appointed head of UN Women.
Mass atrocities that included violence targeting women and girls have occurred in the past year in the context of a diverse situation as DRC, Mali and Syria. And this has to be a challenge that we face together. In other contexts, such as Afghanistan, there has been increased targeted killing of women leaders and human rights defenders.
The latest resolution calls for an end to sexual and gender-based violence, but also calls for more women to be involved in peacemaking, which has often been the province of men. Anne-Marie Goetz is the chief advisor to UN Women on Peace and Security.
In 1995, there were no women from Bosnia involved in the Dayton Accord discussions. In the Arusha agreements for Burundi in the year 2000, two women out of 126 delegates. Right now, there are a number of peace processes where there are no women sitting at the table.
The UN has been working to practice what they preach. Five peacekeeping missions are women-led, but this year only 3 of 10 UN-backed peace deals provide for women's political participation. And the UN has struggled to end impunity, at times among its own blue-helmeted personnel. This February, the UN nearly stopped supporting 2 Congolese military battalions after soldiers raped 130 women and girls. And UN peacekeepers in Haiti have been accused in a string of rape allegations. In 2007, over 100 Sri Lankan peacekeepers were sent away after allegations of abuse and misconduct. Again, UN Women's Anne-Marie Goetz.
The UN is not a court. The UN cannot itself prosecute these violations, especially when it's a matter of troops and police that are donated or volunteered from member states to come to peacekeeping missions. But the UN has to make sure and follow up with member states that these violations are prosecuted domestically.
The latest resolution's been lauded as a step in the right direction. But according to top diplomats, member states ended up removing a provision that would have vetted peacekeepers for past human rights abuses. Stephen Fee at the United Nations, New York.
As Libya marks the 2nd anniversary of the death of Colonel Gaddafi, the country potentially finds itself on the brink of civil war. As security forces struggle to contain violent militia, the government has been hit by accusations of widespread corruption. FSN's Daniel Wrenches spoke to Tripoli-based journalist William Crisp.
The mood on the streets in Tripoli today has been very downbeat compared to last year. People are very concerned about the situation. The security has deteriorated significantly over the last 12 months. We've seen increase in assassinations, in bombings. Militias have become a lot more powerful. And as time goes by, there's a real sense that Libyans are losing hope.
Not least because there have been incidents where the security of the government itself has been in question.
That's right. Of course, Libya at the moment is relying on a fractured group of armed militias, increasingly in conflict with each other. It's not a good situation any way that you look at it, and it's definitely been getting worse over recent months. And really came to attention, of course, with the kidnapping of the Prime Minister 2 weeks ago by a brigade that was nominally under the command of the Interior Ministry. The situation we see now is going to be very difficult to solve.
And some analysts are saying that they think that there is now the risk in Libya of a civil war. Do you think that's putting things too dramatically, or is there the potential for that to happen?
I think that there's definitely an increased risk of renewed fighting, but a civil war suggests two sides, and that is not really the situation at the moment. We have many different competing ideological groups. We have the Federalists in the East who want to see autonomy for the eastern region of Cyrenaica. We have Islamists working against the state in many ways, but now we're also seeing them battling each other. And on Sunday, one of the Islamist leaders actually blamed Federalist militias for an attack on his house, which was RPG'd in Benghazi.
And so you're implying, therefore, that rather than this becoming another civil war, it would be more of a failed, fractured state like Somalia has been.
I think that on the streets there is a sense that the state is failing. As the security situation deteriorates, the government's power does seem to be eroding, and there's a growing kind of tribalism, and some people have called it warlordism, with these large groups increasing their power.
Is there anything that the international community can do in this context?
It's a very difficult situation for outsiders to come into and try and solve, especially due to a certain sense of mistrust that is felt by many Libyans. When NATO intervened during the 2011 revolution, this was welcomed by a lot of people in Libya, but now they're asking, a lot of people in the streets are asking, why did NATO intervene? And they see Western business interests and profits being made by Western companies, and there's this kind of growing suspicion about these actions. Earlier this week, NATO said they were going to provide more advisors to Zidane to help him rebuild security. But this is a very delicate operation, because this could be seen as Western interference propping up Zidane, and instead of helping him, it could undermine his position instead.
William Crisp in Tripoli. The United Nations is pushing for a DRC peace deal to be signed as soon as possible. It comes after talks between the country's officials and the M23 rebel movement once again broke down in the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Nick Harper reports from the United Nations in New York.
It had been hoped that the Kampala talks would end with an agreement between the DRC and the M23 to end the conflict. But after yet more inconclusive discussions, the UN's special envoys overseeing the negotiations are concerned that without a comprehensive deal, the instability and fighting in the east of the country could continue indefinitely. Speaking via video phone from Uganda, the head of the UN's mission in the DRC, Martin Kobler, said the latest set of talks, which had lasted several days, had proved inconclusive.
I do not want to conceal my slight disappointment that after four long days and nights of negotiations until the early morning hours of today, it was not possible to reach a comprehensive deal, despite the pressure of the five envoys as supportive observers.
Some of the UN Security Council, including the US ambassador to the UN, Samantha Power, has just returned from a visit to the troubled city of Goma, where much of the recent fighting has been concentrated.
Our children used to study.
There, they heard firsthand about the problems faced by the civilians still living there, who are defying a conflict that has displaced more than 2.5 million people. The UN has its largest peacekeeping force anywhere in the world in the Democratic Republic of Congo, a mission that has steadily grown over the last decade, now numbering around 20,000. It also has the so-called Intervention Brigade, a 3,000-strong unit of African soldiers with the task of taking on the M23 rebels. But while fighting has slowed, the peace process has simply stalled. At the latest negotiations, the DRC and M23 managed to agree on a number of talking points. Here's the UN Special Envoy for the Great Lakes region, Mary Robinson.
The parties reached consensus on 8 out of the 11 articles of the draft agreement under discussion. These are the release of prisoners, the end of M23 as a rebel movement, and the possibility to re-establish itself as a political party, the return and resettlement of refugees and IDPs, the question of the extorted and looted properties during the M23's brief occupation of Goma.
But as she explained in the briefing to the Security Council, three issues of contention remain unresolved.
Regrettably, the parties found it difficult to agree on certain contentious and difficult issues that had remained problematic throughout the talks, namely amnesty, disarmament and integration of M23.
And still no agreement about how the M23 will transition from a military movement to establishing itself as a political party, something both the rebels and the Congolese government hope for. So with the talks faltering, failure looks increasingly likely. and the prospect of the M23 movement moving into the political sphere still seems a distant hope. Nick Harper, New York.
Now, when it comes to marijuana, it seems Americans have made up their minds. A new Gallup poll shows for the first time ever that a majority of Americans, 58%, are in support of legalizing marijuana. That's 10% more than a year ago, and it comes after the states of Washington and Colorado became the first to legalize the use of the drug for recreational purposes. In Colorado, pot shops are expected to open in the coming months, once state officials finalize commercial and tax regulations for the drug. Meanwhile, marijuana still remains banned under US federal law, but US Justice Department officials recently announced what appears to be a new policy of tolerance, saying they won't try to block states from legalizing the drug, as long as they can put in place strict rules for sale and distribution. FSN's Mary McCarthy spoke to Mason Tavert, Director of Communications of the Marijuana Policy Project, on the changing attitudes towards cannabis.
It's been clear that the Justice Department has been taking a very thoughtful approach to this. You know, people have said they're dragging their feet, but given the magnitude of this policy shift, it takes a lot of time. So it's understandable that they have been taking a while, but it looks like they've really looked at this and decided this is the best step forward. Let's start moving in a direction of trying new state laws and seeing if there's a better approach to marijuana prohibition. You know, most Americans think that there is a better approach to marijuana prohibition, and now they will feel more comfortable adopting that type of approach.
And my understanding is that under federal law, that marijuana does remain a banned controlled substance, but that the new policy is one more or less of tolerance, and that in the states where recreational use is allowed, as long as the states regulate it very carefully, that the government is going to let it go ahead, both for recreational and for medical.
Well, now that the federal government has signaled that states can start moving forward with adopting their own marijuana laws, it's really time for Congress to address our federal law so that it reflects how the people in these states want marijuana treated. You know, in other words, you know, right now our federal marijuana laws are broken, and it's time for Congress to fix them as opposed to simply working around them. So, you know, we hope to see Congress take on a lot of the big issues that are facing this type of law. When it, you know, there's an existing medical marijuana industry in Colorado, and there's soon to be a adult use industry. We need to take on those issues facing them. So now that Colorado and Washington have been given somewhat of a go-ahead to establish legal, regulated marijuana markets, it's time for Congress to ensure that they're able to do that properly. So we need to address issues like banking and taxes and other things so that we can see this system work. And it appears that the federal government is going to make a good faith effort to work with states to make these policies work. We hope to see that happen.
You see it as hopefully the beginning of a process towards actually changing that federal law that still prohibits marijuana.
It's become abundantly clear that it takes a long time to change federal laws. So in the grand scheme of things, we're moving very quickly toward a new approach to marijuana in this country. And this is a major milestone, and we hope to see another major milestone in the near future, which would likely be Congress taking action to resolve this conflict and have a formal policy that addresses the policies our states are adopting. I've certainly had strong feelings about this issue, and so have more and more Americans over the last several years. You know, a majority of Americans want to see our marijuana policy shift. This is a sign that it is headed in that direction.
And that's the Wednesday edition of FSN Reports. Coming up on Thursday, the self-publishing phenomenon that's sweeping the US. That's Thursday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Rebecca Foster. For everyone, with feature story news everywhere. Have a great evening. Goodbye.